I promise to keep introductions short, so I'll try to live up to that. Although it's a bit difficult with somebody like Professor Morton sitting right behind you. But let me just say in a line that he is both historically and contemporarily one of Canada's preeminent historians and has made a tremendous contribution to the intellectual life of this country. With a university background of study, lectureship, professorship, research, as I say, his contribution has been immense, focusing among many things on the First World War and various features of it. He was an advisor to us on putting the program together, and we're grateful for his counsel in the early months of our preparation for the conference. And so to launch us into our program, and on the general theme was World War One, the Great War, the political consequences for Canada, which allows them a lot of territory to explore. I'd like to invite and welcome Des Morton to the podium.
This is a very real honor, and I'm grateful for it. It's forced me to do some of the thinking that you're going to be invited to do, and to do it during a summer when it's felt like 1914 in the Ukraine, in the Middle East, and perhaps even here, when the Prime Minister tells an American audience what he's thinking about doing. Well, the people who are asking in Parliament to find out what we're going to do are treated to irrelevant insults. An interesting comment on our democratic government. But as a historian, I can only tell you it has its precedents. The war that began a century ago last August was tragedy, and undoubtedly, in my mind at least, the greatest war Canadians have so far experienced. The more so because if we recognize that 1939-45 grew directly out of the tragically short-sighted Treaty of Versailles in 1919, there is a pretty obvious connection. And a tragedy that Woodrow Wilson and the guidance that he wanted America to give to Europe was one of the first to surrender that obligation in order to get an organization that was brilliantly conceived and utterly ineffective, the League of Nations. In order to get the leaders of the victorious powers to support the League, Wilson forgot those other principles that were so evident from history. Clemenceau, the French Prime Minister, had been bred and born in the hatreds that France developed because two of its provinces, Alsace and Lorraine, had been stolen from it to settle the War of 1870. Other countries had also suffered during the war and wanted vengeance. The one thing that Wilson had told his people, and anyone who cared to listen to him, not a group probably as large as this, that would cause another world war. And it did. Much like the doctrines of imperial citizenship that burdened a majority of Canadians for the sacrifices of war, we Canadians are regularly assured that the Great War was a nation-building experience. Nations are built, so the saying goes, by doing great things together. Well, Canadians take credit for capturing Vimy Ridge. Did we Canadians do that with both our languages and both our nations present on the scene? Of course not. One battalion out of 48 was all that French Canada had in the Canadian contingent. Though there are other French Canadians, distributed to other regiments where not a word of French was ever spoken by anybody in authority. So we did do it together. We didn't do much together in that war. That's something to think about too. Of course, the 10,000 casualties we suffered in capturing Vimy Ridge, added to the 23,000 we had lost in various battles called the Battle of the Somme the year before, forced us into the cruelly divisive issue of conscription, whose scars are still visible on the face of our Confederation. I believe and will argue that conscription can be justified in 1917 as it would be in 1944. But it's a point of view that I know many people who are fellow Canadians and strong Federalists do not share. Our government had been warned by Sir Willoughby Gwatcan, the British officer who commanded the militia in 1914, that Canada could not keep more than two divisions at the front in any serious war. This was advice that the Minister of Militia and Defence, Colonel Sam Hughes, happily ignored. He had, perhaps not the only Minister of Defence to have this feeling, total contempt for anybody who'd spent their lives as soldiers. And Gwatcan had. In every major crisis where Canadians had been organized to defend their country, from 1870 to 1899, provision had been made in that force for French Canada to believe that it had an involvement. In 1870, half the soldiers sent by Canadians were supposedly coming from Quebec in a regiment that was commanded and operated in that language. Relatively few French Canadians actually joined that battalion, but they had the opportunity to do so, and it was their operation as well. That occurred in 1885, and even in the Boer War, where the 1st Canadian contingent, organized as 8 infantry companies, had kept 2 as francophone. It required forceful lobbying and full backing by what was then Canada's largest newspaper, La Presse, to persuade Hughes to allow one battalion to join the second contingent. He also promised that if you joined as a volunteer, you would fight shoulder to shoulder with your own neighbors and your own friends. That turned out to be a lie. Any of you with any experience of war know that reinforcement battalions are broken up and sent to where the need is. So that although you might have come from southern Ontario, you might find yourself in a British Columbia or an Alberta unit, full of people with a typical attitude to Ontario, right? If you were French Canadian, you had 1/48th of a chance to serve in the only language you spoke or understood. Imagine joining an Ontario regiment, perhaps primarily from Toronto, as a unilingual francophone. Maybe you can begin to understand why francophones weren't all that keen to enlist by 1915 and 16. Nobody will ever tell you that because textbooks are denied the right to tell the truth in Canada. They tell what the government thinks is wise for you to know. The 22nd Battalion, the exception to the rule, was formed reluctantly by Hughes, or permitted, and then he insisted that the command be given to an elderly militia officer he'd already fired for incompetence in running the government cartridge factory. Fortunately, this gentleman had the good sense to recognize that at the age of 67, he was a bit old to be a lieutenant colonel in the field, and found a young man named Thomas Tremblay, who was a major in the battalion, who'd graduated, one of the very few, about 19, from the Royal Military College of Canada, which was operated entirely in English, and where the French was taught by French teachers from France, who regarded the French spoken in Quebec as a crude dialect. 22nd Battalion would prove itself very rapidly, beginning at Courcelette in the opening phase of Canada's participation in the Battle of the Somme, 1916. Colonel Tremblay walked down and stood in the front line, surveyed the scene, climbed up the parapet, and walked across the field towards the Germans. His regiment followed. They had the example of incredible courage, you might say folly, but how else was he going to lead them, except by leading? A tradition that incidentally continues to operate within the Royal 22nd Regiment, which is one of our regular force regiments in Canada. Tremblay stood up, his men followed, and they would do so again at Cherizy in 1918, where only 44 members of the battalion survived intact after 2 days of fighting. The battalion was led out of battle by its chaplain, the only officer who survived intact. Elsewhere, I've written about other French-Canadian units which, thanks to political appointments, negligence, and outright corruption, were failures. In 1917, when reinforcements from these rotten units threatened his regiment's performance, Colonel Tremblay got out of his hospital bed, put on his uniform, crossed the channel, and returned to the battalion. He then began to give that unit, which he regarded as the representative of Quebec, that could not be allowed to head down this hole, severe examples of discipline. After the war, when Quebec MPs planned a parliamentary stink over the fact that 5 out of 25 Canadians who were shot by firing squad were French Canadians, they stopped immediately that they discovered that Colonel Tremblay had signed the death warrants for those men. War is hell. Discipline in war is the secret, general secret of success. The 22nd Battalion went on to become the Royal 22nd Regiment, the Royal Vingtieme, known to the English always, who can't pronounce all these complicated words, as the Vandus. Vandus don't mind that anymore. They always used to. But they do understand that's how English Canadians, not very bright people at that, function. Was conscription necessary for the Canadian Corps in 1917? What if is a question prudent historians avoid. Why gives a lot better value for any inquiry. In the summer of 1916, recruiting volunteers for the Canadian Expeditionary Force had sagged and finally collapsed. Anybody who was going to join had joined. Anybody who wanted to join knew that the Army would probably send them to some place they didn't want to be. This was certainly true for French Canada, but it was also true for English Canada. French-Canadian volunteers could, as I said, find themselves in units where nobody spoke their language, who gave them commands they couldn't understand and gave them severe disciplinary punishments when they didn't obey what they couldn't understand. This makes sense. The heavy casualties emptied the reinforcement depots back in England. And a 5th Canadian Division was formed in England to defend its coastline in 1917, but really to give Sam Hughes' son, Garnet, a chance to continue to be a major general and command a unit in England, a safe distance from the fighting, which, considering Garnet Hughes' performance in battle, was probably a good idea. Arthur Currie, who was being blackmailed by the former, thank God, Minister of Militia, was blackmailed because he refused to give Garnet Hughes the command of a division when he had been hopeless a failure as a brigade major. Those of you who know these ranks and statuses will, I think, understand the point. Sir Robert Borden was in England in the spring of 1917. He was there for a pretty miserable experience. The new British Prime Minister, David Lloyd George, was going to give the inside story on how the Allied campaign was going. And the answer was, it was heading straight towards defeat. The United States, yes, had entered the war, but it had no trained soldiers, and it would take years to train and equip and ship them overseas. So they weren't going to be coming anytime soon. Meanwhile, the Russians, the largest army in Europe, was falling apart with mutinies and mass desertion because of the impossibility to find efficient Russian administrators. For example, the train system in Russia only had repair shops in Moscow. So if a train car or even a locomotive was damaged, it had to be propelled all the way to Moscow. And if it broke down on the way, you couldn't just tip it off the rails because that property belonged to nobles. Well, a Canadian actually solved that problem. He didn't know about the nobles and didn't care less. But a man named Joe Boyle simply knew what a lever would do. With 10 or 15 men hauling on it, you could tip those things off the tracks into who cares whose field and use the railway again. That wasn't enough. France's army had mutinied too after a disastrous offensive in the winter of 1917. And the British Army's defense assault at called the Arras Offensive had failed after a couple of weeks because the Germans had a clever new strategy for defense. They withdrew. They withdrew as far as they needed to let the attackers get beyond the range of the attackers' artillery. As soon as that happened, the Germans, who'd got reinforcements from other places brought in, and who were ready to reconquer, did. The British, of course, were slaughtered. Suddenly they're being hit by artillery. Their own artillery is silent. So again, a bit of a disaster. The Arras Offensive got nowhere. Vimy Ridge was captured and held, but to no great purpose. Was this a propitious time for a Canadian Prime Minister to announce to his colleagues, the other Dominion premiers, and to the Premier of Great Britain, Canada would have to cut its force in half? Is this a good moment to say that? No. Borden might have, but he couldn't, in the setting, say that, well, I'm going to contribute to the defeat of the Allies. And he didn't. Under the gaze of fellow Dominion premiers, Borden had to claim that, well, somehow we're going to solve the manpower crisis. And with the Military Service Act of 1917, yes, they did. They broke repeated promises uttered in every part of Canada that only volunteers would ever go to war in Canadian uniforms. At the start, volunteers had even been discharged because their mothers or their wives complained. Sam Hughes may not rank very high in my mind as a Canadian cabinet minister, but the Hughes family, Sam and his brother James, were devout feminists, believing in the right to women to vote, although this rendered them often accused of being insane. Well, that changed. In 1917, the Military Service Act was organized to produce 100,000 soldiers, not volunteers, and they were gradually found against the resistance, particularly of Quebec, but not of Quebec alone. The rural community knew that if the son went, the father would have to do all the work. However forceful and strong prairie women were, they were not exactly able to manage a team of four horses or to plow fields. You need a certain weight to do that. Every time a son or a father was taken from a farm, its production virtually disappeared. And remember, this is a time when food production is a huge issue. Canadians were told to eat less, tighten their belts, do not hoard, do not save, contribute anything you can to the war effort, but don't eat. Because there was genuine concern about the supply of food, because so many had enlisted. In 1914, 70% of the Canadian contingent, the first one, had been British-born. Of the Canadian-born, the French-speaking share was somewhat higher proportionately than the Anglophone share. Nobody has ever told you that before, I suspect, unless you read French. And even then, as Madame Marois insisted, military history was too disgusting and humiliating to be allowed to be taught. I'm writing a book on l'histoire militaire des Québécois, not in defiance of Madame Marois, whom I found very often to be a very shrewd and intelligent person, but because that story has to be told. Whether I do it in English or French, you will find a whole lot of things that will astonish, surprise, annoy, and amaze you, because it's not a story allowed to be told. But why was this period of conscription associated with a torrent of abuse poured on fellow Canadians of the French language? Did it help Canada's war effort, or was it a support to the Borden government in seeking re-election in 1917? Among the emergency powers the Borden government had given itself in 1914 were certainly sufficient powers to cut off this stream of bile and venom that came from Ontario and the West. It certainly destroyed part of Canada's war effort, as we had to mobilize police and troops to go to Quebec to keep the peace. Yes, the Conservatives won the 1917 election with pro-conscription liberals to help them do it, and they formed our first and so far only union government. But history would treat them pretty roughly. The 20th century would belong not to the Conservatives, but to the Liberal Party of Canada, largely because Quebec was solidaire behind a party that had not broken its promises to them. And even when it did in 1944 introduce conscription, it had also induced other legislation that was very relevant to the Quebec economy. I'll return to that later as I return to issues that are perhaps as economic as they are political, though I insist they're both. Canadian historians, myself included, have been perhaps negligent in looking at the economic impact of the Great War 1914-18. An American colleague, Eric Rauchway, at the Davis campus of the University of California, made the point in his book on the Great Depression, published by Oxford as The Great Depression and the New Deal. It's in there if you care to take it. Rauchway is R-A-U-C-H-W-A-Y. And it's a really interesting and valuable book with a perspective I've never seen Canadian historians look at before. So this is new. I'm not saying it's true, but it's certainly new, and I think it's persuasive. The Great War had an impact that would produce the Great Depression. The Europe-dominated world left by the Napoleonic Wars, when they ended in 1815, had Europe grew increasingly integrated economically as the 19th century developed. This was the century when Europe expanded by seizing vast territories in Africa, Asia, and the Pacific. Europe also sent millions of emigrants to settle empty areas of North and South America and Australasia. The receiving states had to borrow massively to help their emigrants find work and incomes in their new settlements. When some European thinkers predicted a worldwide famine because of the increased birth rate after the Napoleonic Wars, it never happened, because the emigrants to Canada and the United States and to Latin America and to Australia focused entirely on producing food. Simple, and To get that food to market required railways, canals, roads, steamships. Those were found frequently by borrowing. But the great thing is, when you borrow to pay for a productive and wanted industry, the loans get paid back. But when the Great War came, governments were pretty sure that they couldn't possibly pay for such a catastrophe by taxes. After all, a conservative government was in power in Ottawa. They couldn't tax the poor because the poor were trying to struggle through a major recession, which had begun even under the Liberals in 1909. 15% employment across Canada, unemployment, no unemployment insurance, no benefits, simply tighten your belt and starve a little. So how could they tax those people who didn't have any income? They would be taxing their own wealthy and dearly wealthy supporters. Impossible. Unpatriotic. Wrong. So what did they do? They did what previous governments had done when railways needed to be built. They borrowed the money. Normally, Canadians went to London, to Threadneedle Street, the Bank of England, to British institutions to borrow money. We'd always refuse to go to Wall Street because it was so greedy and profit-seeking. Well, for wartime borrowing, we didn't have a choice. The British needed their own credit. The Americans were willing to provide. Therefore, Wall Street became the source of the money we used to pay for the First World War. This is a chapter of that history which by and large never seldom gets written and nobody much reads. How boring, but rather crucial. The image of a prospering, economically interconnected world, linked by steamships packed with grain and cattle carcasses, racing to European markets, passing immigrant ships, packed with Europeans seeking a stable income somewhere else, and the rare privilege of land ownership, and the potential of vast wealth. After all, doesn't every immigrant become a millionaire? Some do. And the image is, of course, capable of drawing more people, and does. Anyway, the real change in the world economy came with a great war, when what you borrowed money for was artillery shells. Now, artillery shells may be aesthetically attractive for some minds. They're basically there to destroy things. The more shells you have, the more you destroy in lives and property, in assets of various kinds. So this changed the economy, and not for the better. As any collection of war posters will remind you, governments did certainly turn to the citizenry for voluntary financial contributions. Buying victory bonds was the term in Canada, to provide the munitions that our boys needed in the trenches. To provide a monthly allowance to parents, wives, and young families, a revived Canadian Patriotic Fund. Demanded donations under the slogan, fight or pay. And with a cartoon-type poster, which I thought was quite amusing considering the person who opened this talk, written in English, French, and Ojibwe script, pointing out that First Nations had contributed to the Patriotic Fund, and if Indians can find the money, how come you can't? Well, they did. They also provided something else of great importance to the organizers of the Patriotic Fund, supervision. Ladies from the equivalent of Westmount or Rosedale inspected the homes of soldiers' wives who received these goods and decided whether they would continue to receive them or whether that new hat at the entrance or maybe the piano in the parlor meant that they were so well off they didn't need the money. The Patriotic Fund did not, I'm grateful to say, have a revival in the Second World War. And in British Columbia, such was the resentment to it that it ceased altogether. But it was there to help people get through the war. The victory bonds revealed to succeeding governments that people whipped into patriotic fervor could really give till it hurts, if you remember that phrase. That number was doubled. The first victory bond issue was supposed to get $50 million. It collected just over 100, which was huge money in those days. Thereafter, there is a series of victory bond issues, and each one is oversubscribed, except the one at the end of the war, which was to pay for the costs of ending the war. A bond, of course, earns interest from the Federal Treasury, and it embodies an ultimate promise to be repaid. So those who gave money for victory bonds were doing a prudent thing. They would get the income that money might have earned them at the bank, and they would get repaid at some point in the not-so-distant future. The traditional route to London had closed, as I said. The British were engaged in their own war, thank you very much. So we went to Wall Street. You might think that because we were neighbors of the United States, fellow warriors after 1917, there would be some concessions. But Wall Street operated on the business-is-business principle and took as much as it could get. In 1913, Canada's national debt had been reported as $475 million. By 1918, 4 years later, it was $2.25 billion. A billion was such a large sum in 1918, you could barely conceive it. $1 billion in little folders would fill this room. Too much. Impossible. It was an unimaginable figure at a time when an annual federal government spending in Canada was about $225 million a year. Oh, for the good old days, eh? Well, there was a British debt factor, too. Canada's soldiers might fight in France, for France, but they fought under British auspices. Untrained reinforcements completed their training in England. Canada had readily agreed to cover that cost in full, whatever it was. But not until 1916 did the negotiations become serious. Canada accepted that food, water, clothing, and other basic necessities would cost 5 shillings per soldier per day. Add that to the $1.10 a day the soldier was paid and supposed to send home to his wife and children, and you begin to see the money adding up. That summer, after the 5 shilling sum had been established, the Battle of the Somme opened, and a new tactic became effective. The Germans finally got their munitions industry in order, and they began dropping incredible numbers of shells on the front lines. So did our side. Match, match. Casualties soared, costs soared too. And early in 1917, the British notified the Canadian Overseas Ministry that it would be owing an additional 5 shillings for shells, for artillery. 1 shilling already, 5 more added. This led to bargaining that I guess was pretty tough and not very nice, as you can imagine. But the Canadians insisted they would not pay the additional money because they'd only been notified in 1917. Well, we'll only pay it from 1917 on. What about 1960? No, we won't. We had a deal. It's nice to see Canadians standing up to the imperial powers occasionally, although sometimes it's a bit embarrassing. Because the British were in trouble, too. It took until the summer of 1919 before a British-Canadian agreement on how to pay for our soldiers overseas had been signed and tempers on both sides had been severely strained. Paying for the Canadian Corps overseas added about $250 million to that national debt I mentioned. Canada was, of course, not alone. In contrast to pre-war borrowing for the CPR or the Grand Trunk Pacific, there was no offsetting revenue stream. when you fired the shell and it went off, it wasn't really worth much money, was it? The huge sums had been spent destroying German soldiers and their equipment and their trenches, not to mention Belgian and French buildings and infrastructure. The 67,000 dead Canadians as a result of the war would be costly too. We needed cemeteries. Relatives would demand elaborate memorials as well as lifelong pensions for those who were injured, for war widows, and for other permanent victims of the war. The dead were matched in numbers by the permanently disabled and the mentally disturbed. Shell shock, they called it then. PTSD it is now. It is a very significant factor in our society today. It was even more so then, particularly when most people regarded that behavior as simply proof of cowardice. "It's why we didn't let women join," said one expert on the subject. And if a woman complained about her husband's behavior because he was angry and resentful and fiery temper, his pension was stopped. So women learned they better not tell about these horrible attacks because they would be penniless. Shrewd operations in the savings department. Well, Canada was, of course, not alone in this situation, but it was very bad. What would still happen in Canada, despite the echoes of a 1917 election promise of full reestablishment, was how do we pay the veterans? A Department of Soldiers Civil Reestablishment was created in Ottawa to make sure that people got training if they needed it, people got help, people got allowances, but not if the department could prevent it. Canada was, after all, bankrupt. Yes, we might make nice promises to veterans. We might give them poppies. We might even give them medals. But we weren't going to pay the rest of their lives. Serious post-war debt was, of course, not limited to Canada. Victors and losers alike faced financial ruin. Losers, specifically Germans, also faced massive reparations payments claimed by the victors, guaranteed by the Versailles Treaty, and the German economy was accordingly desperate. Huge inflation. People went to the store with a child's cart full of money, paper money, to buy the week's groceries. And Germans knew that everything about this period was the fault of the victors. They could listen to a little man who'd been a corporal in the army during the war, you know him by name at least, Adolf Hitler, telling audiences that it was not their fault. The Kaiser had told them that Germans are superior human beings who are entitled by their race to rule the world. Hitler said, that right was taken away from us by traitors in our midst, Jews and socialists. We can get rid of them. People would politely applaud. In fact, they would enthusiastically cheer and put on the uniforms that the Nazi Party designed to prove that they were superior beings. All of this because of a financial situation which was insoluble and intolerable. Wilson, as president, had pleaded for a forgiving, not a vengeful settlement. He had failed. And in that failure, the consequences that the victorious Allies took of it, came the making of the Second World War. Paradoxically, Americans had also contributed to the war in the Far East. Margaret McMillan reminded me of this in her book on Versailles. The Japanese had, for once in their history, elected a somewhat liberal government. It was not a government of soldiers or of traditionalists. It was a liberal government that asked one thing from the war. Those of you who know Japanese society will probably appreciate the reasons. They wanted all human beings to be declared equal, in the treaty that settled the war. Well, Clemenceau and Lloyd George, seasoned politicians, a little cynical, said, sure, what's the problem there? We won't meet it and they won't meet it. Wilson went along too. He was an idealist until his advisors reminded him that as a Democratic president, he had been elected by the solid South and they would not tolerate such notions. So he changed his mind. The result was probably predicted by no one. But the liberals in Japan have never ruled that country ever since. And the army, which had extended its tentacles into mainland China during the war as an ally of the West, extended them. And the Pacific War began at that point. If you like to look really back into historical origins, the Japanese in China trying to expand their empire, the Japanese in Japan insulted by the rest of the world. And in a country where face is everything, they had been slapped down. Last August, Maclean's magazine suggested that modern Canadians had lost their British ethnic ideals of solidarity and self-sacrifice that had been the underpinning of enduring the costs and deprivations of the Great War era. Professor Rodway made the same observation of post-war Americans. Though most Canadians earn too little to afford even the poverty line lifestyle that the government's Labour Gazette considered adequate for the wages of working people, most people live with modest debt, owed to parents, friendly friends, neighbors, perhaps even a credit agency of some kind. Paying what was due was the major struggle of family existence below the poverty line, but it had to be done, or you would be homeless and humiliated. Well, that changed after the war. A man of principle, some of them repellent, named Henry Ford, paid his workers well enough to allow them to be customers for his mass-produced Model T. Assembly line economies dropped the price of his car from $950 in 1909 to only $290 by 1926. Even a poor family could begin to think about affording a Model T. Ford's chief rival was General Motors. And it was a major rival because it had a number of shrewd ideas. One of which was planned obsolescence. So that when you bought this year's model, by next year's model would be so much better than the one you paid for, you really couldn't live any longer in the neighborhood unless you got it. Moreover, they created another institution you've probably heard of called the General Motors Acceptance Corporation, GMAC, which was a borrowing and lending agency for General Motors cars. And so if you couldn't pay for it, well, just go around the corner and see Bob in the GMAC office, and he'll see what we can do for you. You'd like to have the car, wouldn't you? You don't want your neighbors sneering at you. Oh, horror. Anyway, one result, statistically, was a dramatic increase in U.S. corporate wealth and of lower-income family debt in the United States in the 1920s. Would we be any different? Canadians are, of course, exceptional people, but they're exceptionally similar to some other people who live not that far away. Post-war Canadians imitated their neighbors. Facing a newly protectionist world in the 1920s, Canada quietly abandoned the notion that it needed three transcontinental railways for its exports. Instead, American investors made Canada the second largest automobile producer in the world. Here, as in the U.S., family debt loads reflected the massive increase in car ownership. While few families had been patriotic enough to borrow the money to buy themselves a victory bond, few people in post-war Canada refused to go into debt to own a Canadian-built motor car. Nor could provinces postpone building the highways and bridges that would attract motorized American tourists over the border. Often, from across a border where nobody much else lived. As Professor Routway argued, war bred a sense of entitlement. You've suffered through the war, now you should enjoy the fruits of peace. Average debt levels in the United States, family debt, tripled. Pre-war borrowing in North America had financed the delivery of profitable products and financed itself. Should the U.S. help out its fellow belligerents? They borrowed the money, didn't they? Responded President Calvin Coolidge. And they would have to pay it back in full. Canada was among the they. In 1928, exasperated by appeals for delay or sharing of the war debts, a sternly protectionist U.S. Congress cut off its heaviest debtors from any further credit. The United States listed Germany, an enemy, Australia, Canada, allies in that war, plus countries like Brazil or Argentina that were careless about their funds. Americans hardly noticed that the Great War had, in that moment, just started the Great Depression. Most Canadian history books still identify the economic depression of the 1930s with the crash of share values on Wall Street in 1929. Some Canadian historians, usually like me from Western Canada, blamed it on the collapse of Canadian grain sales in 1928, itself a reflection of the economic ruin of post-war European economies. They were starving, after all, but they couldn't afford to buy products from us. The war had left Canada and individual Canadians sharing massive debts. The world did not believe we could ever repay. This was the greatest political consequence of the Great War. It's not by and large so recognized by historians who regard these numbers as too complicated. Not something the grade 10 students really want to know about. But it's true. Canadians in 1930, however, chose to give political power back to the people whose policies had led Canada into massive debts in 1914. Not even R.B. Bennett's promised New Deal could save the Conservative Party from a massive rout after a divinely endowed 5 years of power between 1930 and 1935. Not a time when you would like to be living and running the country, I think. It would take more than a generation to restore the Conservatives in 1957 with a minority government. In the interval, Canada fought another world war, this time on, believe it or not, a pay-as-you-go basis, that left the country better off than it had ever been in its history. Ever since income questions became part of the decennial census of Canada in 1911, it had proved that most Canadians lived below an arbitrary poverty line. We were a poor country, a country of poor people at any rate. In 1951, only a few years after the end of the Second World War, the census of that year reported that poverty in Canada was now a minority experience. We changed it from being a predominantly poor country, believe it or not, to being one where most people were in that, quote, middle class. By 1961, the census found only 15% of Canadians were living below the poverty line. And there was talk, echoing from Johnson of the United States, that we should have a war on poverty and eliminate that horrible fact entirely. We probably could have, but looking around this room, and perhaps if I had a mirror, I would say the same for myself, we prefer to get the old people out of poverty by increasing old age pensions and payments of all kinds, so that I know myself, my pension having been cut by dear old McGill, I don't feel rich. I do not feel terrified of homelessness and hunger. And I think that's true for most people, though not by any means all. We made it easier also for the young and the middle-aged to get access to higher education, which may or may not turn out to be a good investment, but at least it's better than nothing. We have no idea whether since the present government took power and eliminated those questions of income from the census as interfering and troublesome, we have no idea whether the poor now are more with us or fewer. But as somebody said, knowledge, indeed our current government seems to believe it, knowledge is a dangerous thing and we shouldn't have any, right? Now, I hope I've given you some reason to reflect on why the First World War had consequences. Most of them pretty grim. Because the Second World War was, for Canadians, not all that terrible. We had 44,000 fatal casualties as opposed to 67,000. We emerged from it with a prosperity that we had perhaps, in most cases, never experienced. And we changed. We had, during the war, introduced unemployment insurance at a time when, thanks to the war, unemployment was zero. We had introduced family allowances, which are probably the most significant contribution to eliminating poverty in the 1940s. We'd introduced subsidized housing through the Canadian Mortgage, Central Mortgage and Housing Corporation, a government corporation designed to produce those houses. We'd done a lot of things during that war that were beneficial for Canadians, French and English, young and old, sometimes very old. But my only worry about that relatively positive memory of the Second World War is that it might produce positive memories or hopes for another war. And that's why the last few days of the Second World War are so important. I remember reading a book called Hiroshima, a horrifying book for a kid. And I remember it much later when I was serving in Japan, going to Hiroshima and seeing it and thinking, hardly anything hurts here. The buildings had all been put back, except for some specific ones like the observatory, which were kept in their ruined state. But then I looked at the whole place. It was really, like a boom town. Cheap construction, unpleasant appearance. A country where so many of the people had died that they were people who never lived there, come in. It was not a community. So that memory of Hiroshima at the age of, for me, 19, and the memory of the war and the rejoicing when it happened, when it came to an end, told me there's something wrong here. We should all visit Hiroshima or Nagasaki, which was a much more established place and where the losses were slightly less. But both places, radiation sickness had destroyed the population as much as the explosion. Those examples have, I think, made it harder to think about a Third World War. And I think when people think about Mr. Putin and the Ukraine, they may remember he controls a much larger stockpile of those arms than the Americans did in 1945. I hope those are thoughts that will help you persuade your friends not to make the experiment. I was appalled when newspapers like the Globe and Mail, The Economist, thought Barack Obama is a coward and a weakling because he won't go to war. And yet we all wish that the Kaiser Wilhelm or Adolf Hitler had been a coward and hadn't gone to the World War either. We were wrong. It was a terrible experience, and it went on hurting long after it was over. Thank you.